This programme was made with the support of the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland.
Welcome to Understanding Irish Muslims. In this episode, we talk to Irish people who converted to Islam, or as some would say, reverted. We also hear about Ramadan and what it was like for Irish Muslims and others who completed it during that hot summer of 2013. We talk also to Irish people who have connections to Muslim countries through missionary work, serving with the British Army and Police, and even some with some family connections. We begin with Ratgar native John King, and he tells me that relatives of his were born in Pakistan and India.
My grandfather's brother, that's to say my great uncle, Thomas, was born in Peshawar in 1877. And another sister was born in Hyderabad, and another was born in a place called Sabatu. I don't know where that is, but it would have been in the Indian subcontinent.
Father Pat Raleigh and Father Colin Murphy spent a number of years in Pakistan working with Muslims and Christians. They told me about their experiences there.
I went to Pakistan really to try and use radio to improve relations between Christians and Muslims.
Okay.
And we got a program on the government station. A lot of people said I should be in FM, but I used the other because I wanted to get to the villages in the far away from Lahore, where you'd have many, many uneducated people at the mercy of extremists.
The Christian community, or the leaders, would say to me, you know, you're here for us. You're not to be here for the Muslim community. So we would basically try to overcome these obstacles, but it wasn't easy.
Father Colm tells us how much he loves Lahore, and Father Pat demonstrates his knowledge of Urdu.
You know, kya ale tik tak, absanai, you know, mera naam ye hai, and so forth. Abse milkar barakoshi hui. That is, I am very happy to meet you tonight. I would say, Pedro or Peter, abse milkar barakoshi hui. That is, it's my pleasure to meet you.
I love Lahore. It's a beautiful place, and the it was one of the capitals of the Mughal emperors, and some of them preferred it to the other capitals, and they did an awful lot with it.
Okay.
They had an awful lot of beautiful buildings and so on.
While serving with the British Army in the Persian Gulf, native of Cork Bill Murphy also learned the local language. This time it was Arabic.
I picked up quite a bit of Arabic, you know. Like.
Oh, very good. And do you still speak a bit, or do you?
Yeah, a bit, like, I don't know, salam alaikum and alaikum salam and kifalak and tamam and mush tamam and,
right.
You know, and counting in Arabic, like.
Okay.
Wahid tani and talata herba hamsa sita ashadisha, you know, so.
Very good.
So, you know, they appreciate it if you do make an effort to speak Arabic, you know.
Jim O'Connell tells us about his father who served with the British police in 1940s Palestine.
Like, I have his notebook there, his patrol notebook, one of his patrol notebooks, and it details very mundane stuff of how the British constable, or the Palestine policeman in general, interacted with the local population, and most of the local population would have been Palestinian Muslim people.
Jim still has his father's patrol book, which explains some of his father's encounters, now read by actor John O'Connor.
16th of November 1947. At 7:30 a.m. on David Street, while on patrol, I contravened Kassam Awada, shopkeeper, for placing boxes outside his shop in a manner as to cause obstruction in the public thoroughfare. The following persons are to be treated as suspicious if they are seen out after 10 p.m. Nimus Shabatini, Hayal Barakar, Abu Falad, Abu Rajub.
One of the earliest pictures I have of him, I believe it's him on a colonial newsreel clip outside the bombing of the King David Hotel in 1946, where there was 91 people killed by the apparently by the Stern gang, and the. He was there in the road, they were taking, you know, they were taking people out, and he would have been only in country a few months at that stage.
29th of June 1947. While on patrol with BC Kennington at 7:15 a.m, I contravened Nima Khalid, a butcher, for not displaying a license in his shop and for having unseasoned meat in front of the door, which was attracting flies. 12th of November 1946. At 8 a.m. at David Street, Old City, while on patrol, I contravened Omar Hassan of Jewish Quarter, hawking sweets without a licence and for causing obstruction in the public way.
In 1946, he was 20 years of age, and I know when I was 20 years of age, I was pretty gung-ho, you know, I wanted to see as much of the world, and, yeah. And you know, and militaristic things kind of appealed to people of that age.
Yeah.
So he joined the Palestine Police, whom I would assume he knew very little about.
Yeah.
You know, for the rest of his life, he had relatives and so-called friends of his taunted him about taking the King's shilling, like yeah. a lot of people who joined the British forces did. But he went off there in 1946 at 20 years of age, knowing nothing of, I would assume about the area, and it was the thing to do. Like a lot of people joined yeah. British forces.
Bill Murphy told me about his first experience of meeting a Muslim man in the army.
There were 6 or 8 of us in the room. And he was actually, he got out of this little mat and he was praying, you know.
Your friend
in the Marines, yeah. And so I got talking to him afterwards and I said, like what's with, you know, the mat and you're kneeling down and doing the, well, he said, I'm a Muslim, you know. And I said, what's a Muslim, you know. So he explained to me then, like, that to the religion of Islam, like, you know. That,
right.
And that, like, whereas we as Catholics then I pray to Jesus Christ and all the saints that we have and all that kind of stuff. He used to pray to Allah, you know.
Owen Yahya Whelan tells us about the 5 different prayer times that Muslims must adhere to each day. We met him at the South Circular Road Mosque with his young child, Mujahid.
The first one is Fajr.
Uh-huh.
Fajr is the dawn prayer, so when the sun comes up. And then Dhuhr is the afternoon prayer, like in the early afternoon. Uh-huh. It's when the sun hits its peak, essentially. Asr is the middle afternoon, when this in between when the sun is at its peak and then when it goes down.
Mm.
And then there's Maghrib, when the sun sets, essentially. And then Isha, when all of the light has disappeared from the sky.
Mm.
But in Ireland, that red glow doesn't disappear in the summertime. It doesn't disappear until maybe about half an hour, 45 minutes, until the sun comes up again.
Okay, so it's based on the sun. So you'd have different prayer times in different countries
yeah,
around the world.
Yeah, and when we fast from Fajr, from when the sun comes up till Maghrib,
okay.
when the sun goes down. So if you're here in Ireland, the days are 19 hours long from
okay.
Fajr, from the sun coming up to the sun. But if you're in Morocco or Algeria, the days are 11 hours long.
Okay.
There's no strict, like, you have to pray at exactly this minute or else you've missed a prayer.
Mm.
From Dhuhr to Asr is about 4 hours, 5 hours, give or take. So you have 5 hours to pray that prayer.
Mm.
So there are people, and it is best to pray your prayer right on time.
Mm.
You know, nobody denies that, it is best. But by Sharia, by the rules, you have until Asr time to pray the Dhuhr. So you have until the next prayer comes to pray that prayer.
Mm.
So say if Asr is at 5 o'clock and Dhuhr is at 1 o'clock, you should pray Dhuhr at 1 o'clock. But if you're working, if you can't, you have until 5 o'clock.
Father Colin told me of his first experience in Pakistan of iftar, which is breaking the fast during Ramadan.
It was the thing we did in the central house during Ramadan.
Uh-huh.
You know, they fast all day from break of dawn to sunset. And then they can break the fast at sunset. And this is a very, very special thing, breaking the fast. So we would have a niftar party, a party for breaking the fast, and invite all the Muslims of the area in for that. Mm-hmm. And this was a great way of breaking the ice. Before that, a lot of the people in the street might look at you suspiciously.
Mm-hmm.
But after that, it was much warmer.
Ken, an Irish convert to Islam, tells me more about iftar at the breaking of fast for converts during Ramadan at the mosque in Clongriffin.
Iftar is basically the meal you have when you're breaking your fast.
Okay. And ordinarily that would be had in the home, but this evening people are gathering together.
Yeah, to sometimes you'd have it in the mosque as well, sometimes as well. Okay. So basically an iftar for a lot of the reverts and just a bit of a get-together.
Right.
Have a good night.
I met Maurice Hegarty, once married to a Muslim, at an iftar party and cake sale for Syria at the mosque in Clunsky.
Well, I married a Muslim.
Uh-huh.
And
so there's a connection.
There's a connection. And we had a son, and it was very important for him that our son had a formation in Islam.
Uh-huh.
And since, from my point of view, that's half of his culture, that was really important for me too. And the only place he was going to get it here was in the Muslim National School. So he went to the Muslim National School and I joined the Parents Association.
Right.
My son is fasting for Ramadan at the moment, okay. So I would have to... Well, at the moment now he's staying with his dad, but for the first week of Ramadan, I was staying up late. He couldn't eat until 10 to 10 at night.
Uh-huh. 10 to 10 at night. And then particularly in this weather...
Or drink, yeah. Where we are tonight is in the multi-purpose hall in the Islamic Cultural Centre.
Yeah.
And people from different countries have cooked, baked... the traditional foods of their countries, from all the different countries that people come from, and there are lots of different countries here.
Yeah.
And everything is being sold to raise money for Syrian relief, for humanitarian relief in Syria. And
what countries do we have here exactly? What Muslim countries? There's quite a variety.
Tunisia, Morocco, Libya, Palestine. We have an Irish table.
An Irish table.
We have an Irish
Fantastic.
Table. There was a tea brack on it the last time I passed.
Yeah.
It's usually brown bread and scones and things like that.
Okay.
I think we have Egypt, we definitely have Libya. The food is fabulous, but what I find so impressive is that these people have been baking and cooking all day while fasting.
Yeah.
And they're sitting there, or standing there now, selling the food, and they can't eat for like another half an hour.
While not a Muslim herself, blogger and lecturer in world religions, Colette Colfer, decided to observe Ramadan to get a better understanding of what Muslims in Ireland experience.
I was speaking to some Muslims at the time, and I was very conscious of the fact that Muslims in Ireland were about to be fasting, that it was in the middle of a heat wave, and I thought, oh, it must be so difficult. I'll try it and see what it's like, see how difficult it is. And I was taken one day at a time, so the first day I managed and then I kept going. Really, it was part adventure, part curiosity, and really for me what it became was an eye-opener about Islam. I felt like it opened a new door of understanding to me about Islam and about Muslims in Ireland and about what the experience, and the experience of Ramadan itself, I felt like I was getting into the heart of Islam in a way.
Hmm.
You know, it wasn't just about no food or drink, it was also about no cursing, it was also about thinking good, about, you know,
controlling your thoughts.
Yeah. So, and I actively did make an effort to do that, which I really enjoyed, and it was challenging because it was all about doing good as well.
Yeah.
And I realised how little opportunity I had to do good. I was waking up in the morning thinking, right, what good can I do today? And kind of hoping that I would have a chance or that somebody would say to me, ask me for a favour or something.
It's reported that the first Irishman to convert to Islam was a man by the name of Patrick Conway in the early 1950s. He later changed his name to Muhammad Conway. Spent some time with other Irish people who converted. Owen Yahya Whelan tells me how he came to Islam.
I lived in Farnbowley, which is at the end of Bird Avenue, the church where the Clonsky Mosque is less than a minute walk away from the church I went to every single week, like multiple times, and I'd never spoken to a Muslim before. For one of them to sit down and go, yeah, there's no doubt in this book. That's ballsy, man. That's seriously ballsy. But I did it again. I went cover to cover, story to story, trying to find the kind of one, the first contradiction where I could go, yeah, if it has one, it has a million. It doesn't matter. If you're saying it's from God, it has to be perfect.
Owen told me about his drinking days.
I used to drink whiskey.
Right.
But only whiskey.
Only whiskey.
Solid whiskey. And my uncle, Robbie, he's well into whiskey as well.
Yeah.
And me and him used to sit down and just polish off a bottle between us, no bar.
And so how has all that changed? How has all...
I just don't do it anymore.
Was it just one day came, or did you gradually phase it out?
it was pretty much just one day. And it's nuts because people all have to say, oh, it's so difficult to change and that, but it's really not. One day, it was somebody's birthday and it was like a Wednesday or a Thursday, you know, midweek. But yeah, we ended up going out from, I think it was a Thursday. And on Sunday, of course, everything closed at like 1 o'clock. And we were like, ah, screw this. And we were like, you know, what's like the closest 24-hour city, the closest city like London to us? Belfast, let's go. And we ended up staying in Belfast. We ended up staying all day. We ended up going out clubbing that night and then coming home.
And was it sometime after that weekend or a couple of weeks after that that you decided, right, that's it?
Yeah, well, I'd still go out, you know, parties and things like this. You know, if someone had a kid or something, you know, we'd go out. But after the first, I think, like two or three months, people would stop offering me drink. You know, oh, do you want a pint? Like, nah, I'm grand. And they'd be like, oh, yeah, you want a whiskey? I'm like, nah. They'd be like, all right. Irish people are really unpushy. Mm. It's crazy. Like, they are really, like, if you
they
have your
they
opinion,
don't insist. Yeah, okay.
That's cool.
Yeah.
They don't care.
Charlotte Keenan from Mullingar tells me how she came to Islam.
So I came. Everyone comes to Islam a different way, and I came small, step by step. And so even up until 5 years ago, I was still drinking alcohol.
Uh-huh.
So if I was still drinking alcohol, I was going to pubs and clubs.
Okay.
I was still putting on. I was only studying music in 2010. So studying music,
right.
That's listening to music in college, making music in college. Doing sound engineering in college, so it wasn't until I learnt about it in Islam that I rejected it as haram.
So listening to music is or music in general is haram. It's forbidden.
Yes.
Okay. So how then did you adapt to that? Because that was like music is such an important part of your life. It was your job. It was your hobby. It was your passion. All of that's gone now for Islam.
I didn't think that would happen. I thought, you know, we're always told if you give up something for Allah, He replaces it with something. So, I think the first thing, okay, from the beginning, I said I was feeling I was Muslim inside. It was only 9/11 that I had to tell people I was Muslim. Then, after a few months, I was thinking, wait a minute, God knows I'm Muslim, but the whole world doesn't know I'm Muslim. And I felt like I was hiding. So I felt like, okay, I'm going to have to do something to show, first of all, to show God, and then to show the people. So the first thing I did to show God I'm a Muslim is I gave up pork, because that's something you do at home. I could eat pork at home and ham every day and you wouldn't know, but God will know. So I gave up my favorite meat for God. And I used to love bacon sandwich in the morning. It was my favorite thing for breakfast.
Mm.
And I can still, I salivate at the smell of bacon.
Mm.
But still, I gave it up for Allah. That was the year 2000. And I never had it since. And it wasn't hard. It wasn't. I just decided one day I'm going to give this up because for God. When you give up, and I've been told since that if you give anything up for God, you change anything in your life, just purely for God's sake, for Allah's sake, then He makes it easy for you and He replaces it with something better. So I think He must replace the pork with all the other halal meat that I eat now.
Mm.
So I never missed it.
Mm.
So that was the for God. And then for the people, to show people I was Muslim, I started covering my hair. It was it's still a big issue, I told you, like my dad calling it, take that rag off your head. So I started, I wearing headscarves. I would get different colored headscarves. I would tie them like this, you know, like a bandana. And then some sheikh in England, because I was living in England, because I was telling him, this is a big issue for me. I'm getting a lot of stick, a lot of hardship, people harassing me for wearing the headscarf. He advised me to make it like a fashion thing. I don't know if that was good advice now, looking back. I wouldn't advise someone to use it as a fashion thing, because then I got a bit addicted to the fashion thing and I bought loads of Kangol hats. I have 50 Kangol hats at home now, all different sizes, shapes, colours, fluffy ones, whatever, and I would wear them all different ways, and I have 50 different headscarves as well, but I don't wear them anymore, you know. So this was my way of covering my hair, showing the world that I'm covering my hair, I'm Muslim.
Charlotte tells us how she had many unanswered questions in Catholicism.
In primary school, very devout, arguing with the priests. The religion teacher hated me because I'd always have questions. She'd say, write it down and tell, ask the priest. So every month the priest would come and I'd have all these questions, and the priest would never answer my questions. He could never give me an answer that would leave me with no other questions. You know, when you're, and with Islam, everything, all my questions were answered. So I'd said to my family, who thought I was going through a phase, like they would, you'd think, right. You know, I went through a phase of colouring my hair in my teenage years and shaving my head and dreadlocks and all that. So they just thought it was another phase. And so 9/11 happened, I would go into town and I'm saying, no, it's not Muslims. We believe we're peaceful. Islam is about peace. And so I'm Muslim. And so it made them think that, okay, listen, it's not as simple as just it's a Muslim who's after going and blowing up the Twin Towers.
Yeah.
It made them think that it's more deeper than that.
Yeah.
And being Irish, I understand how the IRA, and you know, the IRA being seen as a terrorist organization worldwide, and Irish people being mixed up. You know, you go to England and because you have an Irish accent, all of a sudden you're affiliated with the IRA.
Mm.
So because of Irish people understanding that, I can explain that to them in Islamic terms.
Gillian McNichol, who was born in Scotland but has lived in Ireland since the late 90s, tells us how she came to Islam.
So when I did come to Islam, it took me 9 months to put the courage on, to put the scarf on, because I was still working, you know, so I was still in that environment. And I did feel a bit shy about trying to cover appropriately, yeah. You know. So when I did start to wear, I stopped working because I chose to dedicate my life to Islam. I wanted to be at home. I wanted to have children. I asked my husband if it was okay, because the two of us were working at the time. He said, no, it's no problem. Stay home. You can work. So at this time, I just had the hijab and the jalabiya, and that was it. If you believe that the face veil is obligatory and for whatever reason you take it off, it's sinful. You understand?
Hmm.
According to the text.
Okay.
Some scholars, they say this.
Right.
But then you have some scholars that say, no, it's something that's good. It keeps the woman safe. It stops less temptation around within the community.
Hmm.
So therefore, if you want to do it as an act, it's an act of goodness and there's rewarding it. You understand? So there was two opinions. So when I looked at these two opinions, I decided to take the one that was sunnah, that was recommended.
Mm.
You understand? Even
yeah.
though there's ones, there is strong evidence on the one that is fard. There's more compelling evidence on the one that's obligatory
mm.
than the one that is sunnah. But it's a choice. I don't think it's oppressive. What Islam tries to do, it tries to protect the women.
Mm.
Okay? Because if you look at the society today, in all countries, in all nations, the society today is destroyed, you know, by, for example, you know, you have in workplaces, maybe sexual harassment cases, women raped, you understand, indecently assaulted.
Mm.
But what Islam does, it tries to protect this woman by her clothing. Years ago, when I was only 18, I worked in a boulangerie up in Scotland, in Edinburgh. And across in the boulangerie, there was a few men working on a pub across the road. And every money, I was subjugated to sexual torments. And it got out of hand. And at this time, maybe these men thought, she's loving it, you know, she's getting the attention. So what I did was, I saw the number of the company that was doing the work, and I phoned them up. And I made an official complaint. And they came in, and they're looking for this Miss Gillian McNichol. But they didn't realise it was an 18-year-old girl. When they saw me, they were shocked. And they said, can I speak to Gillian? I said, I'm Gillian. They were like, you? And I said, yeah. He said, oh, right, we didn't expect you to be so young. And I said, whatever, you know. And I said, well, I'm still wanting to make the complaint about it. I says, I don't know what went on. He said, you'd think someone at your age would be happy with the attention. I said, I don't care.
Mm.
I says, and I'm scared to come to my job in the morning because I know the first thing that they're going to do is come over and start doing these things to me.
Mm.
You understand? I says, and I want it stopped. And I want it stopped now.
Mm.
You understand? He took them off. He took the two boys and sacked them on the spot.
You know, I'd become more interested in Christianity after going through some changes in my life, you know? And I decided that Islam was introduced to me by a friend. I read the Quran and I didn't convert immediately. It was took me a few months, actually. And what really attracted me to religion is I thought it would take my spirituality to a higher level.
Well, I had my own beliefs on God and religion, but when I actually looked into different religions, I found that what I believed is actually Islam anyway.
Owen tells us how his friends and mother reacted.
It's not that they were supportive or that they were unsupportive. They just didn't care enough, in the best way. Once it doesn't compromise your character, you know, and that's how you know, like, your friends are really good friends, because it doesn't matter what you do or how you live your life, just as long as you, the person, are not compromised by that.
And are you still in contact with those people from those days? Are you still socialising?
No, I would. Oh, yeah, yeah, no, probably. Like, a couple of months ago, I met one of my friends from school in town. Straight away went for a cup of coffee, like, just catch up, and so, like, I'd have no problem. They get it, you know, they don't push, and they don't kind of invite me. One of my mates, he owns a club in Temple Bar, and he rings me sometimes for, like, help with the security and things like that. So I'd go to visit him or say hi to him, help him out. And all of my secondary school friends were there. All of them. They booked out the whole kind of side of it, you know, for like 10 years. It's like, what? It's like, what he's doing? And they were like, yeah, big party. I was like, thanks for the invite, you bastards.
Yeah.
But no, they got it.
Yeah.
They didn't know it because they knew I'd say, oh yeah, thank you, but no.
Yeah.
You know, which is cool.
Uh-huh.
Which is awesome. I'm pretty sure my mother still thinks it's a phase.
Yeah.
I'm sure she still has it in her head that it's just kind of gonna go away,
right,
you know, and I'm just gonna fold back.
Charlotte tells us of her experience.
I didn't tell my family I'm Muslim. No, you're not. You're born Christian, you'll die Christian. You can quote me on that. That's exactly what my mother said to me.
Your social life then completely changed, but you said you did it step by step.
Yeah, so I have so many friends that are non-Muslim. So many.
Even still?
Yeah.
Great.
But yeah, I'm not going to go out with them, and so I mightn't see my friends.
And so when you do see them, in what capacity do you see them? Is it like around the table for dinner? Do you go to houses?
It would be going to their house only. And then, of course, for me in college, during my partying days, that was only 4 years ago, I've friends from there. So my best friend in class was a guy.
Uh-huh.
Imagine. And the course I did was, I was the only woman. The friends, you don't have to get your friends to say it's okay, we accept you the way you are. With me and my friends, you accept me the way I am or just don't be my friend.
This series was produced and researched by Peter Carney for Near FM. It was edited by Peter Carney and Alan Weldon. I'd like to thank everybody who took part in the making of this series. Thanks also to Near FM and the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland for the continued support. In particular, I'd like to thank all those who gave me their time and shared their experience. I hope the experience they shared has taken you a step closer to understanding Irish Muslims.
This programme was made with the support of the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland.